just the whole history from the beginning of aviation almost that Captain Miller's been a part of and a leader of. So, Captain, if you'd like to speak to everybody.
You ready?
Yep.
I had my 101st birthday on December 15th, and I still got some fine. Only trouble is that the FAA won't believe it. They think I'm in a wheelchair. I'm having an argument with them. They say that we never heard of anybody, 101, who wasn't in a wheelchair. And I guess I'm going to have to take a movie of myself and send it out to the FAA. So I've taken the medical twice, and they just arbitrarily cancel it, just like that. And I don't have to, they say falsification, they accuse me of falsification. And I don't have to falsify, I'm in good shape. Never been better in my life. Anyhow, back in 1910, when I was 4 years and 5 months old, May 29th, 1910, Glenn Curtis flew down the Hudson River. You may have all heard that, I don't know. May 29th, 1910. At that time, I lived with my family. Of course, I was only 4.5 years old. And my father took me down to the field where IBM plant is now. That's where he landed for refueling. He won a $10,000 prize. And it was put up by a New York newspaper called the New York World, no longer in existence. And $10,000 in 1910 was a lot of money, enough to retire on. Because money had been printed too fast since then, and devalued. Anyhow, I can remember it, not vividly, but I do remember seeing that airplane take off and fly down the river. And that's the day I lost interest in becoming a steam locomotive engineer. At that time, steam was king. All locomotives were the big thing at that time. And I knew every part of a steam locomotive by the time I was 4 years old. My father was a mechanical engineer, ran a big plant in Poughkeepsie, and he took me down to the railroad roundhouse quite a number of times and taught me all the parts of a steam locomotive. But when I saw that flying machine take off and turn and go down the Hudson River, I lost all interest in locomotives. That was 1910. So during World War I, I saw one more airplane, one or two more airplanes after that. Kingwood Park, where I live now. Somebody's waving a hand at me. I don't know what it's about. Anyhow, that day I can remember the plane taking off and going down the river. And after that, my uncle, or one of my uncles, was in the Army during World War I and trained to be an aircraft mechanic. And the war ended before the training was finished. So he gave me a shelf full of books, of almost 2 feet of books. And I studied them in high school instead of French and Latin. So I flunked French and Latin. But I got 100% in English and mathematics. I did very well because I wanted to be an engineer and a pilot. And Curtis flew successfully down the Hudson River. He was allowed 2 stops. The flight had to be made between sunrise and sunset. He was allowed 2 stops and 152 miles. And he did it successfully on an airplane, about the second airplane he built, and that was over in Hammondsport where he had a motorcycle factory. He even built the engine, and the engine ran, it was a 4-cylinder water-cooled engine. And he designed that and built that in his airplane factory, in his motorcycle factory also. And it was very successful. And then the airplane made the first flights off of a ship in San Diego Bay with another pilot. Ely was the pilot. I got to know Ely. I never got to know Curtis. I always wanted to meet Curtis. And I always wanted to meet the Wright brothers and never met either one or even saw one of them. And that's the only time I ever saw Curtis, and then I saw on the back of his head when he cranked the prop and took off. So I never met them. But when I was in high school in 1923, a barnstorming pilot came to Poughkeepsie. He was flying a World War I Jenny. Now, the World War I Jenny was a two-seater biplane. I don't know how many are familiar with a Jenny. Anybody here familiar with a Jenny? JN4? All right. He had I'm going to sit down. I'm tired of standing up.
Yep.
After all, my legs get tired. He flew down the river successfully and got the $10,000 prize. And then when my uncle gave me this set of books, I studied them instead of Latin and French. So when the barnstorming pilot came, he was sort of surprised because he didn't know much about engines or airplanes. He just knew how to fly. He was in training when the war ended also. And so I helped him. I had a job at a machine shop learning tool making. Each vacation from high school, I would get a job in a machine shop by falsifying my age, so it was legal, so-called legal. And so I was learning how to be a toolmaker. Now, toolmaking is high-precision machine work. It's not making hoes and scissors and things like that. It's making the special tools for manufacturing other things. So by the time I was through high school, I was employable as a toolmaker, which is at age 18 or so. That wasn't bad. So I graduated in mechanical engineering in 1927, and 1 month before I graduated, I went out to Roosevelt Field to see Lindbergh and his airplane. Now, Lindbergh had tried to buy the Belanca airplane. There's just one available, and with a Wright J5 engine. And they wouldn't sell it to him unless he hired their other pilots to fly it. Well, he wasn't interested in that, so he went out to California and had another company build an airplane for him. And he went across, I was out to, out at LaGuardia Field, not LaGuardia Field, Curtis Field, and Roosevelt Field, and I saw him take off on his famous flight. May 20th, 1927. And then I went back to school and graduated 1 month later in June 1927. So that started me on my flying career. However, there was no licenses, no regulations for aviation at that time. Anybody could fly anything, any way they wanted to. So I got a job as a mechanic. First of all, I wrote to Washington and asked them for an application blank for a mechanic's license. The new license had just come out in 1927, and the regulations had just started, and they were not mandatory until after the end of 1927. 1928, everything became mandatory. So I applied for a mechanic's license. And being a mechanical engineer and having worked on this barnstorming airplane in 1923, I figured I could pass the exam. So I didn't hear from him for a week or so, and then I got a telephone call, and it was an inspector. And he said, "We just set up an office at Roosevelt Field, and we have your letter about a mechanic license. So I'll come up and give you the examination." I said, "Come up? Yeah, I'll drive up with a car. We need mechanics because it's illegal for an unlicensed mechanic to work on a newly licensed airplane. And we have a shortage of mechanics. So he drove his car all the way up to Roosevelt Field, and we sat in his car almost all day, and he had a book, and he'd ask me questions. I'd read the book, and he'd ask me a question. How do you time an RX-5 engine, and how do you do this, and how do you do that? And I knew the answers. He was kind of amazed because there was no airplane in Poughkeepsie. There wasn't an airplane around Poughkeepsie at that time. Nobody had one. And a few months later, the Gates Flying Circus came to town, 1927. And so I got acquainted, and they said, I said, you need a mechanic? I said, yeah, we need a mechanic. I said, you got a license? How did you get a license? There's no airplanes around here. So they gave me a job as an airplane mechanic to take care of a Liberty engine in a Curtiss R-4 biplane, World War I airplane. It originally had a 200 horsepower Curtiss engine, which was a piece of junk, and they replaced it with a Liberty engine. Well, I hadn't been within shouting distance of a Liberty engine. But I had the manual, and I had studied it backwards and forwards, so I knew the engine very thoroughly, instead of wasting my time on French and Latin. They were amazed, and they gave me a job taking care of the Liberty engine. I was the crew chief all by myself on that one airplane. The pilot was Ivan McKinney, a hell of a nice guy, a wonderful pilot. And so I traveled around with the Gates Flying Circus for a while until an inspector came around and grounded all their airplanes. Said they were they're unsafe. They only carried a little over 500,000 passengers without hurting anybody, but the airplanes were unsafe. So then I looked for another job. And by that time, barnstorming up to that time was done with Jennies and Standards. And I'll tell you about them. The Jenny was a two-seater airplane with an RX-5 engine. It carried two people, the instructor in the front and the student in the back cockpit. There were about, 2,000 or 4,000 of them built in World War I. After the war was over, they were declared surplus and put on the market. The Curtiss Company they were being built by furniture factories and piano factories and everywhere that could do woodwork and metalwork. And so there were at least 2,000 and possibly 4,000 built. I think it was 4,000. And the Canadians built 2,000, I know that. And then they moved their training field down to Texas because the Canadian weather was too severe, so the Canadians did their training down in Texas. But I had two of those, three Jennies, and two of my crew, one I never did assemble. But a lot of them were bought back by the Curtiss Company and sold for $500. Now they cost the government about $5,000 a piece, so we were getting a very expensive airplane for very little money, really. But even then, $500 was a lot of money in 1923 or something like that. So I had a Jenny, and then a standard J-1. I have pictures of them here, and I'll show them to you later. The standard J-1 was very much like a Jenny, only a little larger, and slightly swept back wings, very slightly, and it was just a little larger biplane, but it was still a trainer, two-seater. But you could convert it to carry four passengers in the front cockpit, and that's the airplane that was used mainly by the Gates Flying Circus, except one, which is a Curtiss R-4, and that had a Liberty engine in it. The standard J-1s that they were using, the World War I standard J-1s, which were similar to a Jenny, a little bigger, had Hispano-Suiza engines in them. And they were a French engine, but they were being built in this country by the Wright Company. A very, very good engine, even by today's standard, a water-cooled V8. And so they were converting them from OX5 engines, which were 90 horsepower, and they would put 180 horsepower Hispano Suiza in them and carry four passengers in the front cockpit, two facing forward and two facing back with their legs intertwined, and charged $2.50 for a one-minute hop. So that's what they were flying when I was working for the Gates Circus. But I was crew chief on that one airplane, which was a Curtiss R4 with a Liberty engine. And everybody wanted to ride the Liberty engine because it made so much noise when it took off. Everybody wanted to ride that airplane. It took off. Well, one, they were flying at Poughkeepsie, and was interviewed by the pilot. He said, "I need a mechanic." And you have a license, but how in the world you ever got a license? Pilot's, mechanic's license, there's no airplane within sight of Poughkeepsie. So I told him this story, and so they hired me. They said, we're going to go, this is Saturday afternoon, or Sunday afternoon, I should say. And by that time, there were two valves blowing in the Liberty engine. And so he said, "I've got two bad valves on the right side of the Liberty engine, and I'll be back here next Saturday." This is a Sunday afternoon. "And I'll be, when you have it ready by that time." I said, "Sure." I'd never been within shouting distance of a Liberty engine, but I had the manual, and I had read the manual backwards and forwards. So I had to take the camshaft off and take two cylinders off and take them home and grind the valves by hand. I had a job in a machine shop, but I didn't dare take the valves to the machine shop to grind them on a grinding machine because it would be against their regulations. So I had to do it by hand, and by the next Saturday, I had the airplane ready. And he came with his girlfriend. He said, "You got the airplane ready?" I said, "Yep, it's ready to go." He said, "You want a job with the company, with the circus? Jump in. We're going to go up to Massachusetts." I forget where it was. Anyhow, Massachusetts. And so I jumped in the airplane and left my motorcycle on the field here, just the hay field, the old Red Oaks Mill field that it turned out to be later. And I went with him. When I got up there, I called my brother back on the phone. I said, "Go get my motorcycle before somebody else gets it." So I had a job on the circus. So this was on a Saturday, and on Sunday, there were hopping passengers with five airplanes, four standard J1s with Hispano engines, and one Curtiss R4 with a Liberty engine. As I say, everybody wanted to ride in that Liberty engine because it made a sort of wild, big noise and everything. So he was on one of these beautiful flying, it went up so steep with all that 400 horsepower, it really climbed. And in one of those climbs, the engine suddenly quit. Just peat pieces out, smoke coming out and everything. He just came around and landed. Everything was fine. It turned out, I wondered at the time, what did I do wrong? Well, it wasn't anything I did. It broke a connecting rod, went through, it just ruined the engine. So he said, "All right, now you've got the airplane, we'll send another engine up here and we'll leave a helper with you and you can have it ready by the next weekend." So that's what happened. I worked that week changing engines. They sent one up by a freight or something in a box and put another engine in it. So I had a job for a while flying around with the Gates Flying Circus, and then the inspector grounded all the airplanes, said that they were unsafe. They'd only carried 500,000 people without hurting anybody, so it was unsafe. So I came home and I bought the wreck of a standard J1, one of the same type of airplanes they were flying. I bought the wreck of one at Schenectady and brought it home in a truck, and I spent 6 months rebuilding that airplane. And that was hard work. I was working 14 hours a day for 6 months. And that was all winter in the garage. and I had to make all new ash lingerons for the fuselage and recover the whole airplane. And I got a Hispano Suiza engine of 220 horsepower out of a spare airplane and a geared engine with left-hand propeller. And incidentally, I still have that left-hand propeller. Beautiful propeller, made to order for me. And later on, I took the gears out and made a direct drive engine. Took the gears, which reversed the propeller. I took the gears out and made a direct drive out of it. And when I sold it, that's the way it was sold. I sold it to a fellow in a young fellow who was working in the Navy Yard at Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And he came over here, and I taught him to fly from scratch in that airplane. He paid me $2,100 for the airplane, which was quite a bit of money in 1928. And then I went to work at, I taught him right from scratch to fly. He flew it home, and he flew it for several years before giving up flying. And I'm sure he's dead by now. Everybody else I ever knew is dead. I had hundreds of friends in other professionals. They're all gone. Otherwise, really lonesome. So I had went down to Teterboro to fly. Teterboro was just a dirt field. No paved runway. Nobody heard of the paved. There was no paved runway in the whole United States. The first one I ever saw was at Miami, and the Pan Am had built that runway. And the first time I landed, I had a hard time finding out where I was because it was so smooth. There was no grass. You couldn't tell how high you were. And that was 1929. Anyhow. The first barnstorming I did with this airplane that I had overhauled and rebuilt with new lingerons, all new covering and everything, it was standard J1 with a 220 HISO with a 220 horsepower left arm propeller, made to order for me. And it was wintertime when I flew it, when I started flying it. And of course, you can't do much barnstorming in wintertime. So I flew it over to the Hudson River, and the river was frozen about a foot and a half thick. In those days, they didn't have all the power plants along the Hudson River that kept the river from freezing so deep. Now the river hardly freezes over at all because there's so many power plants using the river water for cooling, for condensing their steam, that the river never gets frozen that deep. But every winter, the Hudson River would freeze at least a foot thick. And that winter was more than a foot deep. It was very, very heavy ice. The ferry boats couldn't operate. And if you wanted to get across the river, you drove your car across the river road on the ice. So I went out there on the ice with my standard J1 and just finished it with a left-hand propeller and 200 horsepower of my throttle. And I had a piece of clothesline tethered to the stale skin, and I charged people to hang on to the clothesline while I flew along over the ice, and they'd hang on to that clothesline until the image was So I made some money right in the middle of the winter without carrying the passengers up. That's how it flew at that. And some of these trips would be under the railroad bridge. There was no highway, no suspension bridge at that time. That wasn't built until 1930. And I'd tow them up north on the ice, and they'd hang on to those ropes until their eyes were watering, and then they'd let go. But they'd pay me for it. So I was making money right in the middle of winter with the standard. And that would be under the railroad bridge, too. And then I carried a few passengers, too, but it was awful cold. Anyhow, I did some barnstorming the next season with that airplane, but the inspector, that's the trouble. I wanted to carry four people in the front cockpit, just like the gate circus did. And the inspector who inspected the airplane wouldn't let me do that. He said, you can only carry two. Well, I couldn't make any money for it to try. So I sold it to this fellow in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and taught him how to fry it. So he was working for the Navy Yard there. He flew it for just 10 years before he left. Now that airplane is still in existence. It's out in Ohio, being restored. The same engine and the same propeller and the same airplane still in existence. At, what's the name of the college out there?
Ohio State?
King Street? I'll think of it sometime tomorrow. Anyhow, it's out there in Ohio and being restored now. Same engine, same propeller, and same airplane. So I did a lot of barnstorming with a new standard D-25. I bought the second one built. Now that airplane was built in 1928, and it had the first two built had Hispano Suiza water cooled engines, and I bought serial number two, which was had a Hispano engine in it, and I converted it to a J5 engine, right J5 engine. I was flying at Teterboro, which was just a dirt field at that time. Now it's quite an airport. And all that summer, I go back a little bit. First of all, I barnstormed the standard, and I did very successfully with it. And then I went to Teterboro, as I sold the standard. And at Teterboro, I was having pastors and instructing students. Very busy all that summer. And the first two new standards that were built, there's a north-south runway at Teterboro and an east-west runway in the shape of a T. Now, along the north-south runway, there was a whole row of airplanes parked against the fence. There must have been 30 airplanes at least, all parked against the fence, headed north. The last two were the first new standards built with Hisar engines. After that, they were all built with Wright J5 engines. The last two in the north end were two, serial number one and serial number two. New standard biplanes designed especially for barnstorming. Four people in the front cockpit, all facing forward. And so one day, Tony Folker was out there. I never got to know the Wright brothers, and I never got to know Glenn Curtis, but I got to know Tony Folker, because he had a big factory right on the field at Teterboro. And he was there. He came over from Germany and lived here. He had a house on that big cliff across the river from New York City. And later on, his wife committed suicide by jumping out the window and that threw her right down the cliff. Too bad. Anyhow, Tony Folker built a mail plane. I don't mean M-A-L-E, I mean M-A-I-L. And it was called the Folker Express. He built just one. And it was an open cockpit behind the wing, and a big 525 horsepower right engine on the nose. It would carry about 1,000 pounds of mail. And the wing was made of wood, not plywood, but veneer, like crisscross veneer. A very thick wing, tapered. He's the man who invented that type of wing, by the way, on the Fokker D-7 in World War I. That was a fighter. But he made bigger ones. He made trions on the airplanes, trimotors, with a great big wing that was this thick, at least in the center, all of wood. Beautiful airplane, just like a Ford trimotor, only made of wood instead of metal. And he had this special airplane built, a single engine airplane designed to carry mail, about 1,000 pounds of mail, or maybe more. I know it was more than 1,000, a lot more than 1,000. Anyhow, it had this one wing. It was bolted right down on the top lines around the fuselage, and the pilot was right behind it in an open cockpit with this big thick window in front of him. You couldn't see a thing. Wow. So the test pilot, I was there the day he tested. He had a hell of a time getting it back on the ground because he couldn't see what he was doing. We got it on the ground, and Tony Falcon was there. He said, "What's the matter with you? Why did they have to go around three times to do that?" He said, "I couldn't see a darn thing." "Oh, I can fly it." So Tony Falcon got it, and he flew it. And when he came in the land, he started to, he drifted over and he started mowing down airplanes. All the long drove airplanes along the fence, mowing them down with a 525 horsepower engine and a metal prop chewing right through them. What a pieces were flying in every direction. And the last two airplanes on that line were the two first two new standards built, serial number one, serial number two. And he stopped right at serial number two and finally stopped the engine. And it was chewed right through the fuselage without hurting the wings or without hurting the tail. So I bought the wreck and I spent a couple of months rebuilding the airplane. So that was, I had serial number two. And I went barnstorming with it the next year. And I carried about 40,000 passengers at a dollar a head in that one airplane, four at a time. And the flights were less than a minute. Take off, do a wing over, come back down, do whatever, then side slip, fishtail, and land. And I have a photograph showing where the tail skid hit down, made a trench in the ground about 4 feet by 6 feet long. When you're doing that kind of flying, you get so accurate that you can side slip and slip it right down and put it right down where you want. And then I had a man have get out, and another man get in, off they go. They weren't even sat down in their seats yet. And they'd be on the ground still trying to figure out how to put the battery on. And I'm not kidding. That is exactly what was going on. I mean, they would be in the air 55 seconds on the average. I carried 250 to 350 flights in a day without stopping the engine to refuel with the engine running with a 5 gallon can. Never get out of the airplane. And all day long, just hopping this fat. Now, how did I do it? The other barnstormers, they called it barnstormers, they had a megaphone and they sit on a little airfield. We didn't call them airports at that time, airfield, the flying field, with a megaphone, trying to fill two passengers in a traveler or a Waco for $5 or $10 a piece. Well, it took quite a while to find in those days. The depression was going, it was full blast at that time. And they called that barnstorming. I found out the way to do barnstorming is to advertise. At that time, the post office sold penny postcards. Penny postcards. I'd take a car and I'd go all around out in the farmland where they'd never seen it up around. There was no airfield, no farmfield, anywhere around. Dutchess County, all these counties around here. And I'd find a nice big field where I could land and stop and then take off right from where I was without any taxiing. And I'd make a deal with the farmer to use the field. Then I'd get a lot of dynamite, go to the hardware store, you could buy dynamite, all you wanted of it. Boy could buy it. And I'd blast the stumps and the rocks out of the field and get it all ready for the winter. And then we'd advertise with plenty of postcards. I'd go to all the little post offices and ask them how many routes do you have and how many boxes on each route, how many total boxes do you have? And they tell me maybe 400 or something like that. And so I bought twice that many postal cards, a penny apiece, put them in packages and mark them for that particular town. And I get all the postcards each little post office. There were lots of little post offices at that time because everybody didn't have cars. There were more horses than there were automobiles. So anyhow, I hopped the passengers so fast that they hardly knew they were in the air before they were back on the ground. And dig a hole in the ground. I have a photograph of that hole dug in the ground in one of the places. A lot of so many times in the same spot. So after the season was over, I decided to take the vacation. That's when I went to Teterboro to fly for the summer of 1930. And then I bought a Pitcairn Autogyro in 1931. And the Pitcairn Autogyro was the forebearer of the present-day helicopter. Only it was absolutely the safest aircraft that has ever been built in the history of aviation. The Autogyro is utterly safe. There's just hardly any way you can get hit with it except to walk into a rotor and get your head knocked off. But flying them is safe. For example, I bought the Pitcairn PCA-2 Autogyro in May 1931. And they said they would deliver it on May 1st. About the 15th of April, they sent me a letter and said that we won't be able to deliver it until May 15th. And then one morning, I read in the New York Times, one of these little front page boxes on the front page of the New York Times, that Amelia Earhart was at the Pitcairn factory and she was going to buy an Autogyro and make the first flight across the continent with it, with a rotary wing aircraft. Well, the factory knew that was my plan. I was going to make the first flight across the continent with a rotary wing aircraft. So I thought there's something stinks here. So I got in my airplane and I flew down there. And Amelia was there. And she said, I don't want all this technical stuff they're trying to teach me. I just want to fly to California and back. I said, how are you going to fly without knowing the technical side of it? It's a different type of aircraft than an Autogyro. But I knew enough to shut up. So I kept my trap shut and I went to the factory management and I said, look, you've delayed me a half a month and I've already lost three appearances at $1,000 a piece already because of the 2-week delay, half a month delay. So they got busy on mine, which was serial number 12, and number 13 was the last one they built, but she didn't want number 13. So before I even got there, they switched name plates and gave her 12 and gave me 13. I said, I'll take 13 anyway. So I got 13, but it was actually serial number 12. So they finally gave, I told them, now look, I've got to be at Omaha for the Omaha Air Races on the 16th. Got to be there. So they let me have the Autogyro on the 14th. Well, nobody made a trip like that in an Autogyro before, all the way to Omaha, Nebraska, in an aircraft, a brand new type of aircraft. But anyhow, I made it. There and I put on an exhibition on the 17th of May, 1931. And then I just took off, I flew to California. So when I got out there, she found out about it and she made a flight across the continent. And on the way back, she washed it out totally, totally wrecked it. So that was the end of that. Anyhow, I flew the Autogyro at air shows for several years after that. The Autogyro was a wonderful aircraft. It looked like a helicopter, but it had a propeller in front. The Autogyro rotor was almost the same as a helicopter rotor with blades, but the Autogyro rotor, the helicopter rotor, is power driven. And it blows air down to get a reaction to support the weight of the aircraft. And it's tilted forward to move. To move forward, you tilt it. you turn it backwards, you move backwards. A helicopter can move either sideways, backwards, forwards, or anything you want. Turn around, stand still, go straight up and down. Oh, it's very wonderful. The Autogyro couldn't do that. It had a free-wheeling rotor. No power except for getting it started. A little gear to get it spinning to start with. Then you take off quicker than it would keep running. There are aerodynamic forces that rotated that rotor, regardless of what happened in the air. You couldn't stop it. It was impossible to stop it even with a brake. But it was never would stop. And as an example, one day I was towing a banner. I had to make money somehow. And this was 1934, January 26, 1934. And it was a beautiful, beautiful warm day in January 26th. Unbelievable. I took off from Newark Airport, which was that time just a cinder field, no paved runways. And I had a 37-foot banner, 37-letter banner, 37 letters, 9 feet high. Now that's a big banner. And that aircraft was the only one that would tow that banner, 330 horsepower. And I took it off, and peeled it off the ground, you know, and away you go. And I was trying to get some altitude flying up the north side of the Hudson River because I was supposed to circle Manhattan, go north, and then go down the river on the west side of Manhattan, around the end, and back up the East River, and then back down the west side again, and then drop the banner off at Newark again. Well, I was trying to get some altitude, and I was over high ground. There are other cliffs on the west side of the Hudson River there, and there's a place called North Arlington, New Jersey, which is a bedroom town. That is hundreds and hundreds of little houses where people live, who worked in New York mostly. And I was right over in the middle of that when the engine just quit like that. Bingo! Airspeed went to zero, just like that, with that banner on me. I cut the banner loose and looked around, nothing but houses under it. And I looked behind and I saw a little open spot. So I ran and I could hear the whistles blowing. At that time, the factories all blew their whistles at noon and at 5 p.m. Do any of you remember that? All the factories everywhere in the United States, they blow the whistles at noon and 5 p.m. And as I was making this turn to that little spot I could see down there, I heard the whistles blowing. And I thought, gee, that's funny. I didn't say it was noon. And I landed in this spot, it was at the cemetery. Landed, didn't move an inch. That's the way you could fly an autogyro, just like that. Gravestones all around us. Well, we had a hell of a time getting that out from between all those gravestones and getting it on a little road that went through the cemetery. Incidentally, while I was making this turn, there were two great big schools. One was a parochial school and one was a public school, southeast of the cemetery. And I could see the kids coming out of the school. As I made the turn, I could see swarms of children coming out of those two schools because it was noon, lunchtime. And they saw me making this turn, and they all, instead of going home for lunch, they all climbed the fence and started running through the cemetery to get near the autogyro in Atlanta. So before I knew it, I was surrounded by a million kids. So I had to try to keep them off of it because they were going to climb all over it. And I got out of the cockpit, unfortunately, and some kid got up in the cockpit and stole my helmet and my goggles and my gloves and my maps while I wasn't looking. Anyhow, I didn't discover that till the next day. But finally the police came and chased them home. So we parked the aircraft for the night, and the factory, the Wright factory, built the engine. Sent a mechanic over, and they found out that I'd had a top overhaul on the engine at Valley Stream, which was operated by the Wright Company, and I'd had a mechanic do a top overhaul on the engine, and there's two timing discs for timing the valves. And they have little tiny teeth, and you put the teeth together to time the valves properly. Well, he got the teeth, instead of meshing with each other, he got them on top of each other, point to point. And there's a bolt in the middle of it, and when that bolt got hot enough from this climb trying to get out of there, the bolt expanded and those two discs slipped and the engine stopped just like that. So down I went and I was in the field. So the Wright Company, where I made the engines right there in New Jersey, they sent a mechanic over the next day and he retimed it. Then I took it off again in about 100 feet. And the other jet was an absolutely wonderful aircraft. I did several thousand hours of flying and different types of other jets. In fact, the first wingless aircraft in the history of aviation was an autogyro before the helicopter. They don't have wings either. But this is the autogyro, and I'll back up a little bit. After I got through flying the autogyro around the country during the acrobatics, I did acrobatic exhibitions with the autogyro. And in fact, I was the only person to this day who did aerobatics with an autogyro, with a rotary wing aircraft. The Air Force has looped them. I used to loop and roll on top of a loop and all kinds of things with a rotary wing aircraft, 44-foot rotor. And I was the only one who ever did that, all over the country, air shows, all over. And I didn't think there was anything dangerous about it. There wasn't, really, if you knew how to fly it. But then I decided before it's too late, I wanted to fly the airplanes on the airline. So I saw the autogyro, and they used it for crop dusting. And they left it out in the weather out down at in Florida, and a hurricane came along, and it wrecked it. And I had kept that autogyro so well that even the safety wires on the turnbuckle were polished. It was just beautiful when I sold it. And it was a mess when the hurricane destroyed it. Anyhow, I went with United Airlines and I was flying the Boeing 247D, which was the first modern airliner in history. The previous airliner was the Ford and the tri-motored Ford and the tri-motored Fokker, which were just about alike, except one was built of metal and one was built of wood and fabric. The Ford was really quite a primitive airplane, compared with the Boeing. The Boeing was built in 1932-33, Boeing 247D, and I got a job on United Airlines flying the Boeing. Wonderful airplane in this day. It would cruise about 160 to 165 miles per hour, which was faster than anything else in those days. It carried 10 passengers, 2 pilots, and a stewardess. And I was with United Airlines for about a year and a half, and just about to be promoted to captain. You have to fly co-pilot first to know the airplane and to know the routes. So I was about to be promoted, and Mr. Kellett of the Kellett Autogyro Company, also in Philadelphia, came out to Chicago and asked me to take leave of absence from United Airlines to run the tests on a wingless autogyro, no wings at all. And another pilot had flown it, but he was scared of it and didn't want to fly it anymore. So I finally consented to take leave of absence from United, and I went with the Kellett Company. And one of the reasons was that my family was in a house down in New Jersey, and I had to pay for a new uniform and everything when I went to United. And they were going to move me to Cheyenne, Wyoming, and my family was in New Jersey. So I decided to go with the Kellett Company. And I ran the tests on this wingless autogyro. It was the first wingless aircraft in the history of aviation to get an approved type certificate. That was the Kellett KD-1. And that had a Jetta's engine. So I got, I went to Eastern, Mr. Kellett had, went to all the airlines, and that the TWA, American, and all the others, and they turned him down on trying a mail contract. We had arranged with the post office to run an experimental mail service from the roof of the post office in Philadelphia, in the center of Philadelphia, to the local airport, a distance of 6 miles. And none of the airlines wanted to touch it. But he left one airplane untouched, Eastern Airlines. And he'd been turned down by all the others, except TWA said, well, if you make two flights from the roof of the post office in Chicago, we'll consider it. So I flew the Wingless Autozar all the way to Chicago, made two flights from the post office roof in the center of the city of Chicago, one of them in a hailstorm, and did it successfully. And then they said, well, we've decided not to go ahead with it. And I told Mr. Kellett beforehand that that was what was going to happen. They were going to get some publicity out of the first flight from the roof of the post office in the center of the city of Chicago, and I let it go at that.
Want a little water?
Yeah. So there was one airline left, and I went to Captain Eddie of the Eastern Airlines. Well, Captain Eddie had been my great hero in World War I. When I was a boy, I was too young for the war, World War I. But I followed Captain Eddie Rickenbacker's career. He was a very famous race driver, automobile race driver before the war, and became an ace in World War I. But I never told him that. They took me in to see Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, and I showed him on the idea of flying off the roof with the post of the post office for 1 year, and it would be good publicity for the airline. And he hadn't heard about the flight out of Chicago, so he took me on, and he asked me, what salary would you need? So I quoted him a salary twice as high as I was getting by the Kellett Company, and Mr. Kellett almost fainted. He said, that's fine, we'll go. So we got the contract. And so I threw that Autozar, we bid it after it. It sold for $25,000. Today it would cost five times that much, because all they've done since then is print money. You know that I made probably five trips with a DC-8, four-engine DC-8, from New York to New Orleans with the airplane loaded to full capacity with gold bars. Wow. Believe it or not. They had three gold, their gold bars were 40 pounds apiece. They put two of them in each seat and they had them all along the floor. They were giving them away to South American and Central American countries. Huh. You didn't know that, but our government did it. It was terrible. Plane load after plane load, I flew to New Orleans, and they transferred the load from the DC Eastern Airlines DC-4 to a Pan American DC-4, identical airplane. Instead of just flying the Eastern Airlines airplane and we'd trade airplanes, oh, that would be too simple. That would be too sensible, I mean. So I'd get down there late in the evening and they would work all night transferring these heavy bars of gold from one airplane to the other. Pretty darn stupid. One morning there was one short on the count. Bound to happen. And then when the sun came up and it came time for the employees to change, one employee didn't show up. One Eastern employee didn't show up. And his car didn't show up. He had taken one of those bars in his car and vamoosed. So they put an alarm out for him. And what do you think they found him? He went into an Eastern Airlines office in Miami to buy a ticket at another airline to go to South America. And of course, they had a warning about him, so they got him. One gold bar, 40 pounds. I saw enough gold to build a castle or something like that. Boy, I never saw anything like it. And this was your gold that they were given away. And I often wondered, how many of those crooked politicians in South and Central America have big bank accounts now? And that's what probably happened. We gave away tons of gold. Tons of gold! It wasn't in the paper. You weren't supposed to mention it. Tons of gold went down to South and Central America. Why, I don't know, but I guess it went into private hands. So anyhow, I flew for, I got this contract to fly the mayor off the roof of the post office in Philadelphia. Now the post office was a very modern building at this time, and they had a wonderful restaurant right on the post office. I gained about 40 pounds with that. I'm back to normal weight now, same way that I was when I was 18. But I flew 10 flights a day between the airport and the roof of the post office for 1 year. Never scratched the paint on either the post office or the auto job. Never had any problem. Except I checked out another pilot in case one time I got the flu, and I was grounded for 2 solid weeks. We didn't fly it. There was nobody else to fly it. Nobody qualified to fly it. And so after that, I had already asked for permission to check out a second pilot, and they never answered my letter up to that time. But after that, after I was laid up for 2 weeks with a serious case of the flu, I wrote up another letter and I said, I need another pilot. If I get sick of them, I'll run out of a second pilot. So they let me do it. And I picked a pilot who had been flying for a Pitcairn company, an auto gyro, with the old other type that I'd had before. And he and I had been born the same year, with the same height and the same weight, and we looked alike. It was the darndest thing you ever saw. Some people couldn't tell us apart. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, I checked him out, and he was flying the auto gyro with me alternately. So the rest of the year was done successfully. He had one accident, and that was when we were flying at a 55 mile an hour wind on the roof. Now that's quite a breeze, you know, 55 miles an hour. It's quite a breeze. And the wind tipped the auto gyro over on its side and busted the rotor and bent the propeller. But we had a spare rotor and we had it going again the next day. Now he could have prevented that if he'd tilted the rotor toward the wind, it would have prevented, but he didn't know that at the time. And so it chipped over on the side and broke the rotor blades. But that was the only accident we had, and otherwise I never scratched the paint myself. So we flew that very successfully for 1 year, and then I just decided to stay with Eastern Airlines, and I became a captain on Eastern Airlines for 25 years. And had a spotless record on Eastern Airlines, both the autogyro and the helicopter, and the airplanes. Now the airplanes that I flew on the Eastern Airlines started out with the DC-2, the DC-3, several thousand hours on DC-3s, and that was before, during, and after World War II. I was in the Marine Corps Reserve. I was a lieutenant in the Marine Corps Reserve ever since 1929. And they did not call me on active duty because during the war, in addition to being a captain on Eastern Airlines, I was chief test pilot for the Columbia Aircraft Corporation, which was building amphibians for the Navy. And they say, stay there, we need the airplanes more than they need you, because I was too old for combat anyway by that time. too young for World War One and too old for World War Two. If it had been for that, they would have used me in the Marine Corps to fly transport-type airplanes back and forth across the Pacific or something like that. But anyhow, I stayed with Eastern Airlines, and I was chief engineering test pilot for the Columbia Aircraft Corporation at Valley Stream, Long Island, all during the war, and we built several hundred amphibians for the Navy. And those amphibians were used for air sea rescue. There were hundreds of people on ships that were sunk and airplanes that were shot down in the Pacific, and those airplanes were rescuing. They rescued hundreds of people out of the drink. And I've talked to people who were rescued by that airplane. It was called the J-2F-6 Duck. It was a biplane amphibian. And they said, I talked to a couple of fellows, and I said, they rescued me with one of those, but my ship was sunk or I was shot down or something. And I just worshipped that airplane because I'd been treading around in the water for 3 days with nothing to drink and nothing to eat. It was just about dead. And they pulled me out and put me in a bunk in that airplane and rescued me. So they just about worshipped that airplane that I was testing during the war. An excellent airplane. And in addition to that, we designed and built a new airplane, twice the size, a monoplane instead of a biplane. And the war ended before we got in production. We built three of them, one for test to destruction and two for flight test. And I ran the tests on that one from beginning to end. Wonderful aircraft. But by that time, the helicopter was coming along. And by World War II, Sikorsky got the first helicopter flying, the little R-4, and the Sigurdsson helicopter. So as you know, the helicopter has really taken over. I saw an estimate not long ago where several million people, several million, unbelievable number of people have been rescued all over the world by helicopters. It's a wonderful aircraft. Now, I also owned a helicopter. I'm a general now. I owned Pitcairn Autogyro and a Bell helicopter for several years. And I made some rescues myself. And found a lot of people were lost in the mountains and so forth. I dropped food to them in the winter, all kinds of things. The helicopter is a wonderful, wonderful aircraft. And of course, when I was engineering test pilot for the Kellett Company on the autogyros, before the helicopters, I would talk to the engineers, and I'm a mechanical engineer myself. Of course, I'm obsolete now, I'm a bit thought, but I graduated in 1927. After all, I'm obsolete. But anyhow, I had arguments with them about the helicopters. They said, no, the helicopter is 20 years in the future. I said, look, if you don't get busy, somebody else is going to do it. And that's what happened. Sikorsky did it. He was the first one to build a successful helicopter, just like I told him. And so, as you know the story from then on. Anyhow, on Eastern Airlines, I flew the DC-2, the DC-3, several thousand hours, and the DC-4, the DC-6, the DC-7, and let's see, the DC-8. I forget, maybe one or two more in there. And the DC-8 was four-engine jet. And I flew that 5 years. And both domestic to Miami, between the Miami, New York, and Chicago, and the last two or three years all the way down to Puerto Rico. And it was a wonderful aircraft. This was the second jet airliner in the world. The first one was the 707. The DC-8 was a little larger and much better than the 707, a much more modern design than the 707. But the 707 was used more by airlines because it was a lot less expensive than the DC-8. But I flew the DC-8 for 5 years, and then I retired. So then I bought a helicopter of my own, a Bell 47, which was modified to carry an extra passenger. Instead of having the three passengers in a seat with a pilot and two passengers on one seat, they had three passengers on the seat and moved the pilot up into the nose of the bubble, the big bubble. They lengthened the bubble of a foot. And so I sat up in the middle, in the front, the three passengers on the seat. I owned that and flew it for several years, and then I retired again. And all this time, flying for Eastern Airlines at Kennedy Airport in Newark, LaGuardia, and Kennedy, I commuted by air in my own airplane. I live in Kingwood Park, on the east side of the Route 9, just across the road from IBM plant. I've lived in that house since 1920. Before that, it was on a farm a quarter of a mile south of there. And my father owned the farm. And by the way, my father was general manager of the Delaval Separator Company for 1903 to 1947, 45 years. He ran the Delaval plant, which was the largest manufacturing plant in the Poughkeepsie area, with the largest number of employees. So, it was a successful company, and the city of Poughkeepsie moved the border out over the plant so they could tax it. So they moved out of there. And that huge plant along the Hudson River, it was a mile long. The Delaval plant was a mile long, a tremendous plant. It started out with two little buildings when my father took command of it. It employed up to 3,500 men and women during World War I and World War II. So they moved the city line out to include it so they could tax it. So they moved out to Route 44. So what happened? They got taxed out there. They left the state. My father, when he retired in 1947, he said that the Delaval plant cannot survive because of taxes. We have to compete. We have competitors. We have to add that tax onto the price of our product. You know that more than 50% of the price of an automobile today is taxes. Our taxation system is terrible. Japan doesn't have that. The other companies are selling cars in this country in competition. The Ford and the General Motors just simply cannot compete because the taxes added to the price. More than 50% of the price of a car in this country is taxed. How can we compete with them? Well, there they are. So anyhow, I commuted back and forth to Newark Airport, LaGuardia Airport, and Kennedy Airport with my own airplanes. I was the only airline captain in the entire New York area to commute with his own airplane. I was the only one. Awful lonesome. I remember coming in, I'd go down there and get in the stack. You know what the stack is? The stack of airplanes holding for clearance, one above the other, 1,000 feet apart. I go down there and get in the stack as high as 13,000 feet in my Bonanza and make an oval pattern. Well, wait a minute, they go down and be cleared down 1,000 feet and another 1,000 feet, and then the airplanes would land. And then the fog would roll in over the airport and cover the airport, so there wasn't enough runway for them to land on. And then they had to go to their ordnance, but I got down there, and they cleared me for an approach, and I went down in the fog, and I broke out, and there was a little bit of runway left, and I slipped and landed. I was the only one who got on the ground. That happened three or four times. I was the only one who got on the ground. And then there was no airplane for me to fly on. Where's my airplane? They said, they all had to go to their own if we don't have an airplane for it. One time I saw just a little bit of runway was not covered by the fog. I made a tight turn and then I rolled right into the fog after I touched down. I used to fly back in the middle of the night from a trip. I did a trip. And you get radiation fog here at Poughkeepsie. And the tower was closed, so nobody knew what was going on. And I was on top, up in the moonlight or something. And I'd make an approach and land at 00 at Poughkeepsie. I wouldn't even get a clearance because there was nobody around. Nobody around in the middle of the night. They didn't know what, there was no weather report that time of the night because the weather bureau shut down about 8, 10 o'clock or something like that. I get there maybe it's 3 o'clock or something in the morning. And I made 009, I made a lot of them. You can do it on the ILS. So I had a lot of fun. It was hard work, but I had a lot of fun. I flew back and forth to San Juan. San Juan is a beautiful place. If you ever get a chance, go down there and rent a car and go around and see it. But I never had time to do that. I'd turn around in maybe 20 minutes or an hour and 20 minutes and come back again. 2 hours, it was 3 hours and 24 minutes to go down, 3 hours and 33 minutes something, where I was coming back to New York, the schedule. And then after I got married a second time, my first wife died after 30 years and 3 children. And then 2.5 years later, I remarried. And she and I had known each other since we were born. And she was a doctor, an M.D., and Edith Mead. And I knew her husband very well. He and I used to do a lot of deer hunting together. And he was smoking constantly. And he went to war, he wasn't smoking, but when he came back, he was smoking. He smoked from morning to night. One after another. He never was seen without a cigarette in his mouth. And I begged him to stop. He says, I can't stop. I can't stop. I said, oh, yes, you can. You're an intelligent person. You can stop. No, I can't stop. I said, you know you're going to get double lung cancer. He says, yeah, I know it. He was an MD. After all, he was one of Edith's classmates. So he died of double lung cancer, and I'm telling you, that's not an easy death, because I visited him in the hospital, and he couldn't get a breath. He was in pain, terrible pain, and died a horrible death. Don't smoke. It's stupid. Awful stupid. It's murder. But there's no use in making a law about it. You remember you don't remember Prohibition. It started in 1919, and it made liquor the biggest business in the country. They were using that airplane that I had, that I told you about, the new standard D-25, which was designed to carry 4 passengers in the front seat. The bootleggers discovered that airplane was the best airplane in the world to carry whiskey from Canada across the border. They could carry 1,000 pounds of bottled whiskey in 3 trips a day across the border. And all the revenue people were in it for the money too. The government people who were supposed to enforce the Prohibition law, they were in it for the money too. It was one of the biggest businesses in the country. We didn't learn a thing from it. Now we have the drug laws, and the drug business is now the biggest business in this country. Absolutely the biggest business. Think it over. If you forbid something, people are going to do it, and they do. So if there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer them. No questions.
Yes. Why did you want the left-hand propeller?
What's that?
Why did you want the left-hand propeller?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Why did you want the left-hand propeller?
I don't quite understand what you're saying.
Didn't you have the propeller made to spin the other way?
Yeah.
Was there a reason?
Well, the gear reduction. Reversed it. Two gears go in the opposite direction.
Okay. There was some advantage.
Well, I took the gears out and made it a direct drive.
I see.
Yeah, that was it.
Okay.
Yeah. That engine I talked to you about, it had a geared engine that would reverse the propeller to left hand instead of right hand. When I took the gears out, I took the short propeller shaft, and I'm being a machinist, I have to make two flanges to go together, and I put the short propeller shaft directly on the crankshaft, then I had a direct drive propeller. So that's the way it is today, being restored. With the same engine and the same propeller. So, anyhow, I flew on Eastern Airlines for 25 years, and then I took retirement just a little early because my second wife had died, and I would be flying these long trips at night, and I'd get back to Kennedy Airport maybe at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd debrief, and that would be an hour before I start driving home, and I'd get home to my house in Kenwood Park. It was dark and cold, and I said, what am I doing this for? I don't have to do this. So I quit and brought the helicopter, and then I was really busy after that. I didn't have any days off at all. The police would call me, were searching for people, dropping provisions for them, lifting them out when they're injured out in the woods somewhere, or the mountains. And so that kept me busy for several years. And I finally the state of New York bought their own helicopter, a whole fleet of them, and that put me out of business. So I retired a second time. So here I am at 91. I'm in absolutely perfect health. Absolutely perfect health. But I had my first and only automobile accident. And I estimate that I did about very close to 2 million miles of driving without any injury, accident injury, in all that time until I had one. And so that was about 2 years ago. And I was hit by a car. I was standing still when I was hit, and a car was going about 60 miles an hour and hit me. I demolished both cars. The other driver said I was only going 30 miles an hour. Demolished two cars at 30 miles an hour. And I was standing still. So anyhow, I was in the hospital a long time. And so I'm recovering from that slowly. Otherwise, I'm in absolutely tip-top health. Nothing wrong except my hair has been damaged, of course. After all, I was in the Marine Corps, and we had a lot of pistols, a lot of rifle shooting. And then the open cockpit fighters in those days. Now they have closed cabins and heat and everything. In those days they had open cockpit biplanes with a 50 caliber machine gun on the right and a 30 caliber machine gun on the left, right in front of my eyes. If you hit something, your eyes would hit the gun. And boy, I tell you, that 50 caliber is murder on the hearing. On the hearing. I'd hear that gun 2 weeks after I fired them. Open cockpit. Now they have closed cockpits, and their guns are out on the wings today. Well, anyhow, here I am, still in perfect health, at 101 last December.
I think you saw what you
were talking about. Off the roof?
They didn't show the roof part.
But I thought there was a piece in there about flying off the roof of the post office. I don't know.
Okay. But anyway, you know, we want to thank you very much.
I was out for dinner and I didn't get a chance to do it. Okay. Any questions? Come on.
Anybody have any questions?
I have a question.
Okay.
I don't think you... Could you talk about like what the first airplane you flew was and like how you
were? The first airplane I flew?
Yeah.
Was a Jenny. World War I Jenny.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how'd you learn?
The same one that this barnstorming pilot. Oh, the barnstorming pilot was a fellow named Swanee Taylor. That was his nickname, Swanee. And he was a drinker.
Uh-huh.
And he would have passengers each afternoon out at, well, you know where the Dearborn plant is now?
Yep.
On the roof of that?
Yep.
And that's where I was flying. And that's where he was flying, I should say. And, anyhow, what was I going to say?
Did he teach you?
I worked for him all that summer. I was working in a machine shop learning how to be a toolmaker.
Okay.
Learning a trade. And so after work, I'd take my motorcycle and ride out there to help with hot passengers. I'd get a megaphone. And I worked on the engine. And he was amazed that I knew how to fix the magneto. The magneto went dead. I took it off, fixed it, put it back in, and the engine ran. He said, "How'd you do that?" I said, "I read books." After all, I'm a mechanical engineer by that time. So at the end of the year, the airplane was in terrible condition. It was just, there were holes in the fabric big enough for a cat to fall through.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. And so he gave me the airplane. He said, "You can have it. I can get another one cheaper in the spring." So I spent that winter rebuilding that airplane. That was the second, first one I rebuilt. And the next spring it was in beautiful shape, and I had hot passengers with it, but mostly I had instructed students with it. And then I finally sold it to a couple of fellows down at Armonk Airport. Within 2 days they wrecked it.
Well, again, sorry, go ahead.
Did you ever work at the Rhinebeck Aerodrome with Cole?
Well, no, I never worked up there. I never flew the airplanes, no.
No?
I used to go up there and visit them, that was all. Yeah.
When did they come into existence? When did they start flying there at the Rhinebeck?
When did they start flying?
Yeah.
I don't remember what year it was, but I remember one day I was running the old Red Oak Mill Airport. And there was an 80 by 100 foot hangar that the city of Poughkeepsie had built. And they called it the Poughkeepsie Airport. It was just a dirt field, just grass. I think the runway may have been 3,000 feet long. I don't know. I never really measured it. But you had to come in over high trees and land. And then there was a swamp. And it was very common for somebody to come in over those high trees and float too far and wind up in the swamp on his back. That happened, I don't know how many times. But the swamp ended, the runway ended just like the edge of that table, and then it was swamp. So they're over, and they go over in the back in the swamp, that the heads were up. So I had pretty good business repairing the airplane. I had four men working for me that had it. And we did all right in the Depression. It was hard, though. The Depression was terrible. Really terrible. Go ahead.
Answer to your help, I was based at Stuart in 1961, and I drove up to Rhinebeck to watch him fly in 1961.
Well, I forgot to say that one day I was putting on my acrobatics exhibition at the old airport at Red Oak Mill. Between flights, I'd roll it and loop it and so forth, and it amused the crowd. And this young boy came in. One day I did that, and I had forgotten that the engine crank, there was a crank for the engine, for the start of the engine. It was lying on the floor of the front cockpit, which is an open cockpit. And I remember I rolled the airplane over on its back, and the crank fell out. And bounced off the fabric of the upper wing, and then fell to the ground. I just hung there upside down, watching, trying to see where it was going to hit. But it was too far. I was 1,500 feet. I was up 1,500 feet, and I couldn't tell where it to hit. About a year or two later, a young boy came to the airport carrying the crank. I said, "Where'd you find that?" He said, "I found it behind my dad's shack in the back of the house. It's stuck in the ground." That was Cole Palin. He was about this high.
I heard a story about you and the co-pilot flying in a DC-3 talking back and forth about being wiped out by the Depression and hiding behind the curtains over the radio compartment. Hiding behind the curtains in the radio compartment behind the pilot seat and calling the steward. And when she came up, there was nobody flying the airplane. Is that true?
I didn't quite get the story now.
Well, the story goes that you were flying a DC-3 right during the Depression.
Yeah.
And that you and your co-pilot were talking about committing suicide over the intercom.
About what?
Committing suicide.
I don't hear that.
He thinks he was saying you and the co-pilot played a prank on the stewardess. Did you and the co-pilot play a prank on a stewardess and talk like you were going to commit suicide and then hide and call the stewardess into the cockpit?
Well, I remember there was a baggage compartment between the cockpit and the cabin.
Yeah.
And one day, we rang the bell. We opened the windows. We rang the bell. We hid in the baggage compartment. And the stewardess came up to us and said, "No problem, the windows are open. The windows are open." You're back in the cabin screaming, "No pilots on the airplane." We went back in the seats and we're flying. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
The stewardess almost died. So the passenger. I both committed suicide. I'm no passenger girl. She was the only one that would try that out. We did that several times. We did it with the DC-8, too. Yeah. All the DC-8 people, four people thought, one of them had, there was a pilot in one of them. Some amateur pilot. I don't know whether he would have ever got that DC-8 now. Well, the days of the piston engines and airlines are long gone. They're all turbine engines, either turboprops or turbojets. And there's been a tremendous change. And the turbine engines are, the piston engines were very, very reliable. And all the flying I did, I don't know how many thousands of hours it was in the DC-3 alone. And all the other, well, the constellations, four types of constellations, the DC-4, the DC-8, the DC-6, the DC-7, all those airplanes with radial engines, and I never had a only one failure in all that time. And that was a rod, a pure rod. And there had been at least three, that had the same failure resulting in a fatal crash. And I looked at the manual, and the manual said, in case an engine fails, throttle back, go to idle cutoff, turn off the generator, turn off the firewall, shut off, and then feather the prop. I said, this is insane. Insane. By that time, you have no air pressure to feather the prop. And in a windmill at high speed, like 3,500 to 4,000 RPM, one of them threw a blade off a prop and went through the airplane and killed the stewardess. I said, if I have an engine failure, I am going to feather the prop instantly and then pull the throttle back and the rest of it. So one day I was flying fat, dumb, and happy down the road to San Antonio, in Houston and San Antonio, And everything was going smooth, a beautiful day. And all of a sudden there was a loud thump. You could hear it and feel it. And I looked, there were four little tachometers. And I looked at the tachometer, and the number two wiggled. I reached up and punched the button on the feather button instantly. Within a half a second, started the feather while I still had oil pressure. And then I pulled back on the throttle and all the rest of it. And I said, the engineer said, what did you do that for? I said, we lost number two. I said, finish the checklist. There's a whole list of things to do. But the engine with the prop was feathered and the engine was stopped. That's what it was. So we got down to, went into Atlanta. And I stopped the airplane. This is a Constellation, you know, a good Constellation. And about a couple hundred people on board. And we parked the airplane and a pool of oil formed on the ground and a column of smoke come out of that number two engine. And I said, take the collar off, I want to see what happened. Well, it's 14 cylinder engine, there's seven cylinders in the front row and seven cylinders in the rear row. And they're missing, you know, they're 14 cylinders. And the connecting rod on the front row is a massive steel rod, tremendous, had broken. And it punched its way right through the steel cylinder and cut the feathering line. The feathering line was about an inch in diameter, and that's the one that fed the oil to the propeller to make it feather. I had the prop feathered before the feathering was cut. So the engine stopped, and that was it. No problem. And they said, boy, that really worked. You know what? They didn't even bother to change the manual. They still stuck by the old procedure. I don't know. So, that was the only failure of an engine over about 25,000 hours of flying just for Eastern Airlines. I have a total of 34,000. And some people have more than that because they flew for airliners longer than I did. But I did an awful lot of other flying, all kinds of experimental flying and everything, which didn't require a lot of hours. But anyhow, that's the only engine failure that I had on a scheduled flight. I was on a check ride once, instrument check flight, in a DC-3. Johnny Gill was the pilot checking me. You have to take the check flight every 6 months, as well as a medical exam every 6 months. I never had any trouble with either one. And this day, we were over Newark, and he even gave me a check ride, an instrument check ride. And I made an instrument first down to 100 feet and held it for 30 seconds and then climbed to the Luhrer. And I could smell the oil refinery southwest of Newark when we went over it. I could smell it. You can smell the fumes. And at that moment, the right engine quit. He'd already shut down the left engine. As soon as I started that climb, he shut down the left engine and feathered it, which he shouldn't do. So I climbed on the right engine, which was the hardest one to climb because the center thrust it to the right side of the engine. I'd have to explain that farther. When the left engine fails, that's the worst one. That's called the critical engine. Anyhow, I just leveled off, and the red engine quit. Quit. I said, that's a dirty trick. He said, I didn't stop it. It stopped itself. So I had the business of running on the ground and keeping it, and I had to get the left engine started. I got it started at 700 feet. Boy, the smell of that. That oil refinery was really strong by that time. So I got the left engine started at 700 feet. It didn't want to start right away. It was cold by that time. And so we had to fly back to LaGuardia. I said, don't you want, everybody go to the north. No, they've got to have the airplane tonight for a trip. It was a brand new airplane that had just been delivered, and it didn't, had never been in service at all. They had ferried it from the factory to Miami, put the entire interior in it at Miami, the Eastern Airlines shops, including all the radio equipment and everything. And then they ferried it up to New York, and I drew it for an instrument check ride. And then they were going to use it in service that night. So anyhow, I said, we're going to land at Newark. Oh no, they've got to have it tonight over at LaGuardia. So we flew over to LaGuardia on the left engine. And I noticed that it was detonated. And I pulled back on the throttle, Richard mixture, and it's still detonated. I could hear it clinking. And he got out, yeah, you could hear it. And we went all the way across Newark, all the way across the river, and all the way across Brooklyn, all the way to land runway 4 at LaGuardia, with that engine detonated. We got it on the ground, and Rhett sent two more engines over that night and changed them at night. Two engines ruined. Because that detonator would damage the engine. But it kept running.
Captain, I want to thank you very much.
Did this show anything?
It showed really good pictures behind. Huh? It showed auto rotation.
It showed me flying off the roof?
Didn't show you off the roof.
Oh, it did.
No, I'm sorry. Would like you to come back and do that next time.
I was out today, this afternoon. I was only in the house a few minutes when he came to get me. And I'm sorry, I had a film, a video film of flying off the roof.
I see. Yeah. I see.
Now, the auto gyro landed just like that. It put it out and landed on the tail, skid, and then the front wheel just comes down.
I see.
It was a wonderful aircraft. Right. Absolutely wonderful. Right. Nobody ever got hurt in an auto gyro.
Right.
Well, I'll take it back. There was one student who was taking off right at Pitcairn Field, and he hooked his wheels on a power line and went down and killed him.
Oops.
But it was not the auto gyro's fault by any means. Otherwise, there was never even a serious injury, and they wrecked them all the time because the people would not listen. But the aircraft, you've got to know the aerodynamics of an aircraft to fly it properly. Yeah.
Well, you know, I want to introduce you as a young lady.
What's
here. This young lady was a stewardess with Eastern Airlines. I think she may have flown with you.
What's that?
This young lady was a stewardess at Eastern
you
Airlines.
Have to make her.
She was a stewardess at Eastern Airlines.
Oh,
I may have flown with you.
No kidding.
So I want to thank you all
what type of airplane?
For the association.
I have here DC-8s, DC-9s, DC-8, DC-9, stretch 727.
Oh, those are light ones.
1011s.
Yeah. The most modern one actually was the DC-8. Mm. And that's considered obsolete now.
Yeah, well, we flew the 1011s.
Did you fly on them?
In the 70s.
DC-8?
Yes.
Yeah. It was a beautiful airplane.
Mm-hmm. I have pictures of
it.
Airplanes that you flew.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to look at them?
That looks like a picture in there one.
What is the uniform that you have? Is that your...
This used to fit.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Did they
how
have
long were the service?
14 years.
You don't look that old.
Oh, I'm very old.
Well, I got my wing. Everybody used an airline wing.
Yeah, see?
There's
mine.
The duck.
Yeah.
You know, that's a duck gun.
Oh, okay. I was wondering.
It's supposed to be a wonderful duck.
A mallard duck?
Yeah.